Welcome to Eastern Standard, produced for WEKU by Dynamics Productions. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for joining us. As commentator Paul Harvey used to say, and now the rest of the story. In this case, the story of Daniel Boone, or more specifically, the story of the women who inhabited Daniel Boone's world. Women whose lives have been reduced to little more than scattered footnotes within the historical record. 25 years in the making, there is now a book, Traces, by Patricia Hudson, published by the University Press of Kentucky, from page one, a riveting page-turner of historical fiction. Patricia Hudson, welcome to Eastern Standard.
Thank you so much, Tom. Thanks for having me.
And Traces is a retelling of the Daniel Boone saga through the eyes of his wife, Rebecca, and her two oldest daughters, Susanna and Jemima. And we'll get to that story in just a moment. But first, how did you come to the title Traces? How did that come up?
Well, Traces has a double meaning. One being simply that there's very little of note in the historical record about the women. So there's only a trace of them left in the historical record. But of course, the first road that Daniel Boone cut into Kentucky was originally called Boone's Trace.
I know you've been working on the book for many years, and I'm just curious, how did it begin?
Well, in 1996, I walked into a bookstore and just happened to see a biography of Daniel Boone. And I've always loved history. I was a history major in college. And so I brought it home, and I kind of went down a rabbit hole. Boone was fascinating, but the women fascinated me even more. And I wanted to know more about them. So I began to do some research. Probably if there had been enough in the historical record, I might have written a straight biography. But when I discovered that that was not going to be possible, I decided that the women's story needed to be told, and I decided to do it as a novel.
Well, as I mentioned, the book is absolutely riveting. From page one, there's a very loud, disturbing pounding on the front door in the middle of the night. Can you give us a sense of that? Maybe read a passage from that first chapter.
I'd be happy to. The Forks of the Yadkin River, Colony of North Carolina, 1760. A heavy pounding woke Rebecca from a deep sleep. She sat up among the blankets in the corner bedstead, still only half awake, and for a few seconds thought she'd dreamed the sound. But when she saw the shadow of her 11-year-old nephew, Jesse, scrambling down the ladder from the loft, she realized it was not yet dawn and someone was on the porch, hammering their fists on the cabin door. She reached for Daniel, then came fully awake as she remembered he'd been gone these past 2 weeks, serving as a scout for the Carolina militia, patrolling the mountains to the west amid rumors of Indian trouble. Gone, always gone. Their closest neighbor lived more than a mile away. She and the children were alone. She swung her feet over the edge of the bed, untangling the folds of her shift from around her legs. The winter air was icy. She pulled a blanket off the bed and tugged it around her shoulders as Jesse reached the bottom of the ladder, his linen nightshirt ghostly in the half-light. 9-year-old Jonathan peered blearily down from the loft, but the two younger boys, James and Israel, remained asleep in the trundle bed pushed close to the fireplace. Those two could have slept through the second coming. By the time Rebecca stood up, Jesse had already slipped across the cold floor and pulled the rifle off the wall pegs. The gun was taller than he was, but Daniel had taught him how to use it. "You'll need to be the man of the family while I'm away," Daniel had said. Those words had made Rebecca's jaw clench. "That's your job," she'd thought, "not his. He's just a boy." A metallic click echoed through the cabin as Jesse pulled the hammer back on the rifle and shook powder into the pan. Each night since Daniel's departure, he'd made sure the gun was loaded and ready. Rebecca gestured for him to follow her as she stepped toward the door. A man's voice, muffled at first through the heavy oak door, grew louder, his tone desperate. "Rebecca, open up." She couldn't be sure the voice was Daniel's. It sounded too frantic, too full of fear to be her husband. She hesitated a moment, then nodded at Jesse, and he steadied the rifle, leveling it at the door as she slid the crossbar away from the frame and stepped to the side of the casement. Clutching the bar like a club, she eased the door open a crack. For a heartbeat, she didn't recognize Daniel's face, shadowy in the moonlight. His eyes were wide, and he was breathing in great, shuddering gasps. She dropped the bar and flung the door open. Daniel took two steps into the cabin, then bent double, leaning on his rifle, sides heaving. She felt heat rising from him amid the bitter air that followed him inside. "Jesse," she said, "close the door." She heard the scrape of wood as the boy obeyed, but her eyes remained on Daniel. She wanted him to speak, wanted him to look up so she could read his face. She was afraid to touch him. It seemed to her that even the weight of her hand might bring him to his knees. Jesse lit a candle, and as the flame sputtered to life, Daniel straightened, and the circle of light fell across his face, revealing a look of such love and relief that Rebecca gathered him in her arms. "We've got to pack," he said. We don't have much time." His eyes searched the room, seeking out first Jesse, who stood behind them with the rifle at his side, then Jonathan coming down the ladder in bare feet, and finally the two tiny figures snuggled together in the trundle bed. "I've been running since nightfall. I was so afraid I'd find." His voice broke, and he stopped to gather himself. "Get the children dressed, Becca. Indians headed towards the fort. We have to get out."
So there had been a lot of gossip around a widely held suspicion that one of Rebecca's children was actually fathered by Daniel's younger brother. And you dug into the origins of those rumors. What did you learn?
I wanted to see if I could trace that word again, trace all the way back to the beginning of the rumors. And I've done just a ton of digging in what are the Draper papers. Lyman Draper traveled into the backcountry, collected a lot of information from many, many informants, and he had a whole section about these rumors that he called Boone's Surprise. And I have come to a conclusion. It's a bit of a spoiler, though, so I will say that I wanted to write a scene where if you believed the stories were true, you could see how it might have happened. If you believe the stories are not true, it also will be, I think, understandable that way as well, which may sound a little confusing, but, you know, I did have to come to a conclusion, obviously, as a novelist, and I did based on information that I found. And I am actually now writing a scholarly piece for Appalachian Journal to lay out all the evidence that came out of the Draper papers.
I appreciate that spoiler alert. I haven't quite gotten there yet, so it's good. And but, you know, the heaviness, the weight of it all, and Daniel's difficulty and unhappiness with life as a tenant farmer really come through in Chapter 3. Can you offer just a few excerpts from the chapter in the time we have?
Certainly. One morning, not long after their arrival in Culpeper, Rebecca woke before sunrise with her stomach churning. She slipped off the pallet, pulled on her cloak, and felt her way outside the cabin, then ran her hand along the rough log wall that led to the necessary. She sat in the dark confines, retching and shivering. By the time she made her way back to the cabin, the sun was just breaking over the horizon, bathing the bare limbs of the apple trees that marched in rows across the hillside in pink-hued light. She climbed the rickety porch steps and leaned on the railing to catch her breath. The Boone family friends who had taken them in had offered them the use of this tenant cabin, but despite the aura of friendship that surrounded the arrangement, it was clear they were expected to work the surrounding fields just as any other tenant would. Rebecca turned her back on the first rays of light that shone above the orchard, crossed the porch, and eased open the cabin door, hoping the rusty hinges wouldn't squeak. The interior of the cabin was beginning to grow lighter. When she lay back down beside Daniel, chilled to the bone, he opened his eyes and looked at her quizzically. "I'm expecting," she said. "When?" The look on his face told her this was unwelcome news. "Late October, maybe early November." She tugged on the blanket and turned her back to him to hide the tears that pricked her eyelids. The first two times she told him she was pregnant, his response had been to lift her in his arms and whirl her joyfully around the room. Now she lay stiffly in the dark, her mind racing. After a bit, Daniel slid across the pallet and spooned his body against her back, draping his arm over her side so he could rest a hand on her stomach. He let out a long sigh. "You know I love youngins, Becca, but another mouth to feed." His voice trailed off, and that was all he said. As Daniel began to breathe deeply, his arm heavy on her side, she lay awake, listening to the rustle of the boys as they shifted in their blankets. Since their arrival in Culpeper, Rebecca had felt Daniel growing more distant from her with each day that passed. Their abrupt uprooting had changed him. and though she wanted to unburden her heart to him, she no longer knew how to start. It had been a shock for all of them to go from being in charge of their own homestead to scraping by as hired help, farming someone else's land. Culpeper County was a good deal more civilized than the Forks, and here they were viewed as refugees from the backcountry. Rebecca watched a shaft of light trace a slow course across the cabin wall, and a girlhood memory came to mind. The time her brothers had found a crow with a damaged wing. She'd watched as they fashioned a cage and carved a splint, then helped them scour the barnyard for worms to feed the glossy bird. The injury healed nicely, yet one morning they'd found him lying stiff and glassy-eyed. "Wild things can't be caged," her father had told them. Rebecca shifted uneasily as she realized the expression she'd seen on her husband's face in the thin morning light was the look of a wild thing, desperate to make his escape.
This was not the Daniel Boone of Fess Parker fame, was he? Well, after all of the research that you have invested in this project, Pat, what stands out to you as a message about what we think we know about the lives and times of Daniel, and especially Rebecca Boone?
When I think of Rebecca and her daughters now, what comes to mind is that old saying about Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers, you know, where, you know, Ginger did everything Fred did, only backwards and in heels. Mm-hmm. And when you think about these women and what they had to deal with, most of the time they were pregnant. So they were going through all of the same hardships the men were, only pregnant, caring with a large number of children. Rebecca wound up having 10. She also took in these two nephews to raise, and then later in life took in 6 more orphan children that were from the family. So I think just the perseverance of the women, the fact that they were there, I just kind of wanted people to realize when we think about the frontier, we think about the men, and the women were there, and that's what I hope this book will show folks.
Patricia Hudson, author of the historical fiction Traces, Giving Voice to the Women Who Surrounded Daniel Boone. Traces is published by the University Press of Kentucky. Thanks, Patricia.
Thank you, Tom.
In 2019, the NFL published a list of football's 100 greatest game changers, and among the legendary athletes and coaches was one broadcaster, former Miss America, former Kentucky First Lady, Phyllis George. The first female anchor of a major network sports show, George broke the glass ceiling in sports journalism, and she embodied the complexities of the women's movement of the 70s. And there is a book about it. Phyllis George, Shattering the Ceiling, published by the University Press of Kentucky, is the first biography to be written of George since her death in May of 2020. The book is co-written by multi-award-winning author Paul Volpani and Emmy Award-winning television and film writer Lenny Schulman, who's on the line with us now. Welcome to Eastern Standard, Lenny.
Thanks, Tom. Love being here.
So Phyllis George grew up in Denton, Texas, but married a Kentuckian, John Y. Brown, was instrumental in getting him elected governor, and many in her adoptive state came to claim her as a Kentuckian. Why? What distinguished Phyllis George?
Well, I think it was her celebrity at the time. As you mentioned in the intro, she had become a huge television star as the female voice of the NFL Today, which was the preeminent football show of its time, other than the games themselves. Even though it aired on Sundays, it was still one of the top 20 shows of the week, even though it was in a time slot that was outside prime time. So Phyllis had become a huge celebrity at that point. So when she was campaigning with John Y. Brown for his gubernatorial campaign, huge crowds came out, not so much to see the candidate, but to see this celebrity, this Miss America, Phyllis George. And she is credited with winning that election for him. And the political reporters of the day who we talked to for the book quite agree that it was her celebrity that put him over the top.
Well, Phyllis George and John Y. Brown were the ultimate power couple of their time and a couple of type A personalities. How did that work for them?
By all accounts, pretty well, although Phyllis, by the eyewitness accounts that we researched, certainly wasn't taking any guff from her husband or from anyone else. She was a very active first lady, did a lot of organizing, a lot of projects, and really is known for the work she did with the artists and artisans of Kentucky, going up into the Appalachians, discovering these people who had been ignored forever, really, and taking their work and selling it to places like Bloomingdale's and Neiman Marcus and giving these folks a nationwide market where they had none before. So she did quite a lot for the arts in Kentucky, was very activist, and might be argued accomplished more than her husband during those 4 years.
As a matter of fact, chapter 12 begins with a Phyllis George quote that I like. It goes like this: there's a difference between being sweet and innocent and being a tough broad. Yeah. She was kind of both, wasn't she?
She was. She was a small town girl from Denton, Texas, and really had a bit of a sheltered life. Her mom certainly was pushing her in the direction of doing something special. She had piano lessons early on with a world-renowned pianist, just things that little girls in Texas probably didn't have normally. But with that naivete, she also had this drive to do something great. And Miss America was just really the start of it. She was really driven to succeed in a career. And I believe that, you know, taking that mantle of Miss America and just going so much further with it to accomplish so much more with her brains than just with her looks really is an important part of her legacy.
Well, you do write that her life is defined by her professionalism, that strength of character you talked about, and also an uncanny ability to leave an indelible impression on everybody she met. Tell us more about that.
Yeah, so we were fortunate enough to be able to contact dozens and dozens of people whose lives that Phyllis touched. And to a person, they commented on her star quality, but also her ability to light up a room with her smile, but also one-on-one to make them feel so important as well. It was unanimous. There was never she was this, she was that, or she used her celebrity, or she, you know, was stuck up about this or that. To a person, people commented about her openness, her graciousness, her friendliness, and just her ability to relate one-on-one to whomever she came in contact with.
In a review, another former Miss America and spouse of a former lieutenant governor of Kentucky, Heather French Henry, writes that the book is a wonderful journey through her moments of triumph and her darkest struggles, highs and lows. What would you say made Phyllis George's short list of triumphs?
Well, it was every girl's dream back, you know, growing up in the late 40s and 50s. I mean, Miss America was such an exalted position that I don't think, you know, a lot of people could do much more than dream about it. But to achieve that, and to achieve it through talent as well as look, she was a fantastic pianist, was certainly the number one achievement. But being Miss America in 1970 was also being Miss America in a very turbulent time where the women's movement was just coming into its own and reaching its first peak. And the women's movement would not be looking kindly upon Miss America as a tradition that they wanted to see continue, or they wanted to see be a barometer of what women were supposed to be like. So to have that kind of scorn thrown her way from a significant segment of women, and then 3 years later to achieve the sort of success she did in broadcasting, where she became a hero to women and a trailblazer to women. And I like to say she was the Jackie Robinson of women in that field in a lot of ways. I mean, that is an enormous accomplishment to be able to build on the one and go even further and bring into the fold even the folks that would have doubted her.
Well, her former fellow CBS Morning News colleague Bill Curtis, now a regular on NPR's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, says this book ought to become mandatory reading for young women who think they face a glass ceiling. And I take it that's what Curtis was getting at.
Bill was incredibly kind to us and incredibly giving with his recollections of Phyllis as his co-anchor of the CBS Morning News. And there was a lot of backbiting. There were a lot of people at CBS who did not want to see her move over to the news division, who did not feel like she paid her dues. And really, it's just a continuation of the kind of discrimination she faced when she got the football job to begin with. There, just an awful lot of people did not want to see her succeed as a groundbreaker. And Bill Curtis was there and saw it firsthand. So his testimony is really important to give readers a taste of really what Phyllis was up against.
To me, Lenny, the darkest but also a humanizing passage in the book is about the coincidence of the pandemic and Phyllis's surgery in Lexington, with her daughter Pam and her grandchildren camped out in a car in the hospital parking lot. And it was a reminder that after all is said and done, we're all humans, and COVID was ruling at that time. Did you say that's a fair assessment?
Yeah, so Phyllis faced her blood disease with incredible strength and graciousness and secrecy. She had been suffering for almost two decades with this, and even her closest friends did not know the seriousness of her affliction. So she plowed forward with her life no matter what. And yeah, by the time that COVID hit, the disease had advanced to the point where she really, really wasn't strong enough to get out of the hospital. And so she had seen her first grandchild. She wasn't able to visit with her second grandchild in person. And it was certainly a very difficult time for her daughter and her son, both of whom were enormously close with her and close to each other as a very tight-knit family. So to not be there in the room for a long time certainly was a jarring reality and indicative of what a lot of, unfortunately, families had to face with COVID.
Well, as you researched for the book and wrote the book, what would you say you enjoyed most in your discoveries about Phyllis George?
I think it was just fascinating to me to see the relationships that she was able to establish with people like Roger Staubach, who we got to interview, and people like Dave Callens, the great basketball player, who we got to interview, and see her carve out this niche as a person who was able to bring forth the human side of these athletes, which, you know, I guess we're starting to get more of today. Whether we want to get more of it is a separate issue. But back then, we weren't getting a lot of behind the scenes and being able to see these folks as human beings. And I think that really is Phyllis's tremendous legacy, that she was able to pull that out and show us the people behind the face masks and the uniforms.
All right. Television and film writer Lenny Shulman, co-author with Paul Volpani of Phyllis George, Shattering the Ceiling. It's published by the University Press of Kentucky. Thank you, Lenny.
Thank you so much, Tom.
We're going to step over the state line now and visit with Emily Hilliard, former West Virginia state folklorist and the founding director of the West Virginia Folklife Program. She's out with a new book, Making Our Future, Visionary Folklore and Everyday Culture in Appalachia. It's published by the University of North Carolina Press. Welcome to Eastern Standard, Emily.
Thanks so much for having me.
When I hear the word folklore, I tend to think of the traditions, beliefs, customs, the stories, often passed down through generations by word of mouth, actually. So looking into the past to inform the present, what is visionary folklore, which implies looking forward?
Yeah, so in this book, I'm really thinking about how folklore, while it draws from the past to engage the present, is also a way for communities to envision the future. So folklore is a creative act, and it is a collective act. And together, in those communities where traditions like quilting or old-time music or gospel or foodways of many cultural traditions are being practiced, in passing that on, it's actually a way for communities to envision the future that they want to see for their communities and how they want those traditions to evolve and survive.
I'd like to get your thoughts on a passage I came across in the press release about your book. It says that you, quote, challenge the common perception of both folklore and Appalachian culture as static, antiquated forms. First, folklore. What is the common perception?
Yeah, I think people think of folklore sometimes as things that aren't true or the old-timey ways. I think in West Virginia that often got coded as, you know, the old-timey ways of white people in the mountains. But folklore is actually very diverse. Everybody has it, and it is dynamic. So there's part of the tradition that has to stay the same. Maybe the song retains a melody or it retains lyrics, but in order for it to remain relevant, it also has to change. So maybe those lyrics change a little bit, and, you know, they take on a place name of where the song is being played. Or if you tell a joke that you learned from someone, you add your own flourish to it, or the family recipe that you got from your grandmother, maybe you add a special twist. Maybe you add extra sugar or bourbon, or maybe you don't like raisins, so you leave the raisins out. So that's the way that folklore evolves and stays relevant. So it must change, and it must be dynamic.
Yeah, I guess we kind of think of those traditions as sacrosanct. You can't possibly put more sugar in grandma's whatever. But not so, huh?
No. So for folklore to stay relevant, it really does have to change. And when folklore is no longer relevant, it dies. So if a recipe is maybe no longer considered delicious, or if it calls for too many servings and, you know, you don't have a big family gathering anymore, you probably don't make that recipe anymore. So in order for it to stay in circulation, maybe you alter the recipe so that it only serves four, or you make it, you know, pertinent to your standards or the taste buds of your family and friends. So that's the way folklore remains in our lives, by changing through time.
Okay, and the Appalachian culture is static and antiquated. Appalachia's been looking for a long time to turn the page on some new narrative about it, a portrayal of the region that places it in the 21st century without sacrificing the character of the region. Mm-hmm. Is that your aim in this book?
Yeah, definitely. And I learned that by watching the communities that I worked with. So one of the chapters in the book is about the West Virginia teacher strike. And I saw West Virginia teachers drawing from tradition. So they were citing, you know, the mine wars, and they were wearing red bandanas, which were symbols of Union solidarity during the mine wars. And some of them carried signs that said, "We are the daughters of Mother Jones," but they're also singing Tom Petty songs and Rihanna songs and making new signs and referencing, you know, Star Wars or The Simpsons in their signs and the way that they were forming a new identity through their chants and signs of protest at the state capitol. So they were really using folklore, expressive culture, as a way to create solidarity as teachers.
I noticed another topic in the book is the collective counter-narrative of a multiracial coal camp community.
Yes.
Talk to me about that.
Yeah, so that is Scott's Run, West Virginia. And Scott's Run was visited by Farm Security Administration photographers in the 1930s, like Marion Post Walcott, Ben Shawn, Walker Evans, and it was an incredibly diverse coal camp community. I think there were 19 different ethnic groups living there at the time. But as a result of these Farm Security Administration photos, it sort of became a poster child for the war on poverty, because living conditions were very dire there. And Eleanor Roosevelt visited the camp, and it inspired her to start Arthurdale. So Arthurdale ended up being only accessible for white and American-born citizens. So many of the people who lived in Scott's Run could not move to Arthurdale, this government-funded homestead community. And so in Scott's Run today, they have created a community museum, and their counter-narrative is that we were integrated before our neighbors. We had an integrated pool. We had systems of community sharing that crossed ethnic lines and racial lines, and we just needed more support. So what Eleanor Roosevelt was trying to create in Arthurdale, we actually already had in Scott's Run. We just did not have the material conditions that we needed to live well.
It's interesting. And one more I'd like to ask you about, the cultural significance of the West Virginia hot dog. What's that, what's that about?
Well, when I moved to West Virginia in 2015, I noticed that there were a lot of hot dog joints and that people had really strong opinions about who made the best hot dog and what went on a West Virginia hot dog. So generally, it's chili, slaw, mustard, and onions, but there's actually a slaw line, an invisible slaw line that runs through the state that's been documented by the West Virginia hot dog blog. And above that slaw line, slaw is not really available if you ask for one with everything. And so what I was realizing is that these hot dog joints were often the only place to go in small towns, you know, particularly in the coal fields. And it was a place where you might go on a first date, or if you win a baseball game, or after a funeral. So it was this kind of community space. And people really developed strong preferences for their hot dogs. At the same time, there is immigration history to the hot dog. So there was a 1920s paper I found that said, Charleston, West Virginia is one of the best places on earth for hot dog eaters. And I think that at that time there were four hot dog stands in Charleston, and at least three of them were run by Greek immigrants. So there's this immigration history to the popular hot dog in West Virginia.
And so, wait a minute, there's a slaw line?
I sort of think of it as a Mason-Dixon of condiments.
That's great. Well, speaking of lines, we often say here in Kentucky that in truth, there really is no border between eastern Kentucky and western West Virginia, or western Virginia, northern Tennessee, or for that matter, western North Carolina, which is a stone's throw away, that these regions of Appalachia share a lot of common cultural traits and history. And I wonder, do you agree with that view?
Yeah, I think that's definitely true. When you get down into the coal fields, there's a lot of, you know, crossing. And we know that culture doesn't move along state border lines.
Right.
These are really fluid things. So when I was working as the state folklorist, sometimes I felt a little confined to just, you know, keep my work to West Virginia when we knew that these cross borders into Ohio and Pennsylvania and Kentucky and Virginia. So that is not really the way culture works. It's fluid and it crosses borders. And particularly in you know, southwestern Virginia and eastern Kentucky, there are families who live across the border and, you know, really have a shared culture down there.
We have an Appalachian Regional Commission whose territory of responsibility stretches from Alabama and Mississippi all the way up to Pennsylvania and New York. But from your perspective, do you think that this particular region within a region, kind of central Appalachia, needs its own distinct representation in some way?
That's an interesting question. Well, I think that it definitely has its unique qualities. So perhaps it would be beneficial to have some kind of advocacy group, you know, working for those areas or and with those areas, definitely in collaboration with the communities. But we also have, you know, the organization I work for now, Mid-Atlantic Arts, I'm working on a Central Appalachia project that actually works in three states. So we're in Virginia and West Virginia and Ohio. And that allows me to kind of do more of that cross-border work and advocate for at least those three states in Central Appalachia. And we work closely with South Arts, who sort of has the other three states of Central Appalachia, so Kentucky, Tennessee, and North Carolina.
Well, how can folklore work as a way to bring people onto the same page, to unify?
Yeah, that's a good question. Well, I think folklore is a great way to find common ground across positionalities. And I often turn to food because everyone loves to eat and everyone has, you know, their favorite family traditions that they make for special occasions. But if you start looking closely, you can think about how there are common foodways across cultural groups. So one example would be pies. So you can really look for some kind of pocket food that's, you know, some kind of meat or vegetable wrapped in crust. Every culture in the world has something like that, for the most part. So empanadas, hand pies, spanakopita, you know, the list goes on. And I think food is a great way to kind of bridge these cultural gaps, but also to bring people together because everyone likes to sit around a table and share food. But folklore in other ways, music, dance, can be other ways to bring together people from diverse backgrounds and positions.
Well, I think if you're offering hot dogs and with chili and slaw, you're going to get a lot of takers.
Yes, I think so.
The book Making Our Future, Visionary Folklore and Everyday Culture in Appalachia, published by the University of North Carolina Press. The author is Emily Hilliard. And is when is the book publishing?
It will be out November 22nd, but pre-orders are out in the world now. So you might be able to find it at your local bookstore.
All right, Emily, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up after the break, how Center College partners with a New York theater organization to give students a chance to work with and learn from the pros, and the latest event from Lexington's Green Room Exchange.
We try to create cross-cultural experiences by bringing artists and musicians from other countries here.
I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
Major support for WEKU comes from Kentucky's Touchstone Energy Cooperatives, supplying reliable and trusted energy information. Co-ops offer updated electric vehicle news and an EV calculator to help members make the change to charging. More information at togetherwesaveky.com. WEKU is supported by Hicks & Funson, Kentucky lawyers Josh Hicks, Greg Funson, Kenny Heumann, Kayla Combs, and Mitch Whitaker provide legal representation for car and truck accidents and other personal injury matters. More information at 859-777-7000. And now back to Eastern Standard with Tom Martin.
In many lines of work, when it comes to learning the ropes, nothing beats an opportunity to closely observe how the pros do it. And that's what drives a collaboration between Center College here in Kentucky and the Farm Theater in New York, as we hear in Bill McCann's conversation with Matthew Halleck, Charles T. Hazelrig Endowed Chair of Theater at Center, for the latest in our series on theater production in Kentucky.
Welcome to Eastern Standard, Matthew Halleck.
Well, thank you very much. I'm happy to be here.
Glad to have you. So tell me about this collaborative program between Center College Theater and the Farm Theater. What's the collaboration and how does it work?
Well, it is a two-year program where the theater department at a given college or university will be partnered up with one or two other colleges or universities. And collectively, the two or three of us will commission a new play from an early career playwright through a program called the College Collaboration Project, run by the Farm Theater. And the Farm is a theater that is out of New York City, and they coordinate the whole program, and we're just sort of happy participants.
So how long has Center College been involved with the program?
Well, we got in on the ground floor of this idea back almost 10 years ago now. We're currently in our fifth production that we're doing through the College Collaboration Project. So we've been there since the very start.
Who's the playwright that students are working with? Tell us a little bit about that individual, what their background is, perhaps a bit about their play.
Her name is Deneen Reynolds Knott. And she's written a play called Put Yourself Out There. Or rather, I should say, she's in the process of writing a play called Put Yourself Out There. The entire college collaboration project is about assisting the playwright with the writing of their play. The piece is about a group of college students and recent college students and their struggles and challenges in finding their people when they are at a college or university. Colleges and universities tend to have their primary student body, and then they have the people that struggle a little bit more to feel like they have a place there. And the play that she's written is really zeroing in on those people and what did they do to build a community for themselves or to build a support network for themselves or build a sense of belonging for themselves at this place that's away from home. So it's very relevant to a lot of our students' experiences, and we're really looking forward to start taking a swing at it.
What role do your students play in this? What role do you play in this, for that matter?
Well, in this particular production, because I'm a theater designer, I don't direct plays, so I'll serve as the scenic designer for this production, but I'm also somewhat the facilitator of the partnership. That's been my role over the last 10 years. The students will play, well, they'll play all the roles in the play. That's the first thing they'll do. But they'll also be engaging as assistant directors, as dramaturgs, as designers themselves. And so they're going to be in on the ground floor of the creation of a new piece of theater. And that's really the most exciting aspect of this project, is that the students get to see a play come to life almost from the blank page.
What do you mean by that?
Well, I mean, so often the students, of course, are working on established scripts that have been published and, you know, in some cases produced hundreds of thousands of times. You think about your Arthur Millers or your William Shakespeare's. This is a play that, well, it's not finished yet. And it's by design of the program won't be finished until early next summer. That's the timetable for each of these projects. And so the students get to see the play and the playwright working through the process of becoming, and in many cases get to have a direct impact on how that process plays out.
How do they do that?
Well, the playwright will come to rehearsals for a period early on in the rehearsal process. We'll get all of the actors off book or having memorized their lines. And then the playwright will fly into town and we'll have a few rehearsals with them, and they'll watch their play on its feet for, in some cases, the very first time. And through that process, they'll start rewriting things based on what they're seeing and hearing. And so our students, the work that they're doing is informing what the playwright is thinking and feeling about their work. So it's a really impactful role that they play.
You've mentioned that what the students are doing, but who are the students? Are they theater majors or only, or are they music majors, or are they from all over campus, or who are they?
Well, Center College is a small private liberal arts college, so everybody gets to do everything if they want. The students that participate in productions at Center are theater majors, they are theater minors, they are economics majors, they are pre-med majors, computer science, you name it. You don't have to be a major or a minor to participate in our work here at the college.
So how do they qualify to work on it?
They will audition just like a regular old play. The play will rehearse in January, and we will perform it early on in February in our spring term.
That's kind of towards the end of the process, right? It will have been nearly 2 years at that point. How did they get involved earlier than that, earlier than the actual production?
Sure. Well, the first step of the process that the students have an opportunity to be involved in involves a trip up to New York City to do what we call table work. So the playwright will get the play into what we'll call rough shape, its first draft, where they're ready to start having people read it. And then we all converge on New York, the representatives, students, teachers from the different schools involved in this particular collaboration. And the director of the company will cast New York actors, and we will all sit in a room around a table and read the script out loud. And from that first reading, we'll have discussions and debate, and we'll engage in thoughtful contemplation about the characters and the plot and the setting and anything else that comes up, all in service of helping the playwright think about what to do with the play next.
And what other colleges are involved in this current collaboration? What roles do they play in it?
Our current partners are Oklahoma City University and Furman College, which is another small private liberal arts school. The rest of the cast will be rounded out by professional actors in New York. So the students from these schools will also get that opportunity to act alongside industry professionals.
Wow, that sounds like quite an opportunity.
It really is. It gives them a chance to not just like go to New York and see shows and see how things work, but really to sort of be on the inside of the process while they're in their undergraduate programs.
Do you have any final thoughts about the collaboration program?
It's a thing we're just immensely proud to be a part of. We think it's a pretty distinctive and unique opportunity for our students. It really gives them, and I guess this is maybe the thing I think that is the most valuable, is that it exposes for them how everything that happens has to go through a process before it is what we would call done. That playwrights, professional playwrights, will do drafts of plays that aren't going to be very good. Just as they're going to write drafts of papers that aren't going to be their best work. And they're going to do first versions of projects for their other classes that aren't going to be very good. But that's just part of the process, that when you start something, it's not going to be how it's going to be at the end. And you just have to stay with it and commit to the process and know that if you do, there's a really good chance that you're going to wind up with something that you're going to be proud of.
Okay. I've been talking today with Professor Matthew Halleck, who holds the Charles T. Hazelrigg Endowed Chair in Theater at Center College. Thank you for being with us today, Professor Halleck.
Well, it's been a pleasure talking with you.
Lee Carroll and Connie Milligan are the driving forces behind one of those things that makes Lexington unique. It's called Green Room Exchange, and it's this couple's mission to get out into the world in search of authentic world music and bring the people who make it to Lexington for live performances. And Lee Carroll's here to tell us about the latest event happening tonight. Welcome back to Eastern Standard, Lee.
Thanks, Tom.
I touched on the mission of Green Room Exchange, but tell us more about that.
I have an interest in world music, especially African rhythm, and we put together a nonprofit so we could do events. We try to create cross-cultural experiences by bringing artists and musicians from other countries here. We're sort of landlocked in Lexington. If you lived in New York, it wouldn't be a deal. There would be a whole Senegalese community and a whole, you know, different countries. But in Lexington, there's not so much of that intermingling of cultures, and so we saw that as a real mission for us.
And you literally get out there. You've gone to Cuba, Senegal, a lot of places.
Yeah. And Ghana, we've been to several times, and Jamaica. We've been lucky to meet some really fine musicians and bring them in. Ziamora Laugert and Axel Laugert from Cuba. Mm-hmm. Gideon Alawarye from Ghana and his Africania dance troupe. And a close friend of mine, Aliun Gasse, who I produced a record for, and we just finished it, and I'm looking for a home for that right now. So he's from Dakar, Senegal, and I made a couple of trips back and forth.
Your event, Celebrate the Creative, is happening tonight, if you're listening to us on Thursday, November the 17th, that is, at Base 249, that's on Main Street in downtown Lexington. And for anybody listening who's not familiar, what is Celebrate the Creative all about?
COVID impacted all of us. So we had to find a way to raise money to underwrite our events. So in 2020 and in 2021, we did online auctions. So these are auctions of creative experiences. They could be a lesson from a musician, a jazz drummer, or Trip Bratton, for instance. This year, we got some great things for auction. Guy Kemper is going to do a stained glass workshop. Guy has work all over the world. He's amazing. Dave White is going to do mushroom foraging. Lissa Pohl does an executive management training using horses. There's massage, Himalaya salt cave experience. We decided instead of asking artists for their work and auctioning their work, we would ask them to participate and make it a more human experience. And so you get a sense of the how they create and what they do. So the other thing that happened during COVID is we couldn't do any live performances. So my wife, Connie, came up with a great idea, which was to find international artists that live in Lexington so that we can expose them to the general public. We had our first grant winners last year. We gave out grants to these artists, and this year is our second year of giving out grants, and we have three winners this year. We got Lakshmi Siraman doing original Indian dance. She's been to India working with composer there to create original music for this, and she'll be doing her dance at the show. Sophia Wunda, who's from Tanzania, is a fashion designer, and we're going to have African clothes fashion show. And the third one is Regina Harris will be performing capoeira, a Brazilian martial art and dance that originated in Angola, I believe. So those are our three winners this year. In addition, we're going to have the art from last year's winner. So we have a photo essay from the Democratic Republic of Congo by Yamakumba Mabayo, graphic arts from the Iraqi Al Nazare, and a musical performance with Teddy Cabangali, and I'm going to accompany him, and he's going to sing and play guitar. So it's going to be action-packed tonight. $15 to get in. That includes appetizers, but there will be a cash bar. It's very comfortable. They have couches and comfortable chairs. Really a great place to experience music. I know that Origins Jazz does many shows there. Mm-hmm. So it's a great place to hear music.
And all proceeds, of course, go to the cause, Green Room Exchange.
Right. And it allows us to bring more artists into the country and do more shows.
Lee Carroll, along with Connie Milligan, co-founder of Green Room Exchange in Lexington. Thank you, Lee.
You're welcome. Thank you, Tom.
Thanks for joining us. Eastern Standard is produced at the studios of Dynamics Productions. Mike Savage, executive producer. Neil Kesterson, producing engineer and audio editor. Ella Fitzgeraldine, studio dog. We're online at esweku.org, where you can check out the Eastern Standard archive, our series, our partners, and more. And you can sign up for our weekly e-newsletter featuring a preview of the next edition. You can find us on the WEKU app, on NPR One, and on the Google News app. Want to call something to our attention or suggest a topic? Our email is es@eku.edu. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.